Aha! Very good. Number one. I like this one. You are a true living master. We are blessed.
That looks like my handwriting.
No, it's not. Very good. Next one. Thanks for so openly sharing your wisdom and experience. That's very cool. Last night when I couldn't sleep, I did body and present moment awareness meditation and felt very strange energy sensations, especially in injured parts of my body. Then I dozed off and suddenly felt my body floating up towards the ceiling in darkness. I got scared, silently screamed and woke up and fell back into my body. Is it dangerous to have out-of-the-body experiences? Is the mind really separated from the body, or what's going on? Can evil ghosts take possession of my body while I'm out? No, you are perfectly safe. So, you felt strange energy. You were just getting into some nice meditation. You dozed off. It is a state which is halfway between being asleep and being fully awake. And that's probably what you got into. And in that little state, it's amazing just what you can actually concoct. The chances are that you didn't go out of your body. But if you did, amazing. Just imagine you can actually be on this retreat, your body anyway, and you can go and watch a movie. And you don't have to pay. You just float into the movie. They can't see. You can watch the movie and then come back out again. I say that because just up the road there's Carnot Prison Farm. And this guy told the story, it's in my meditation group, he said he was actually from Yugoslavia, and he said when he was about 7 years of age, he had some illness, very, very sick, and you know, they gave him an operation, and of course he had one of these out-of-the-body experiences, when under anaesthetic, you know, floating out of the body, and he realized that you know, he had died. He's only about 7 years of age, and the doctors had him opened up, and they were trying to find out what the cause was. And he said, even though he was only a seven-year-old kid, he knew that they were looking in the wrong place. And he just had a will. Don't look over there, look over here. And one of the doctors, and his son, he had connected with the doctor, one of the doctors you know, looked in that area and saw the problem, said, hey, this is a problem. And so they could actually get him, his body resuscitated, he survived. He said, since that time, he could always leave his body at will. He never said why he was up in Carnot Prison Farm up the road, but he said, I don't mind being in prison. I can leave whatever I like, and they can't stop me. Because he leaves his body and goes watches movies, or go to a nightclub, watches some musicians, whatever he wants to do. So that's one guy who could do that. There's another guy, some of you might remember him. I don't mind saying his name. Remember the old Burmese man, Keith Sword? No, Don, we were Cody, you know him. And remember Keith? Yeah, Keith. He would be able to do that. And his wife complained, Barbara. Because I think she told me this, that he was up doing some air conditioning work in Darwin, you know, on a contract for 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, he's a bit concerned about his wife. So every now and again, he'd come down from Darwin to check her out, make sure that she was behaving. And she said she could feel him around. He said, Keith, look, go back to Darwin. I'm okay. And now those are people I know. You know, they were just really nice people, so they wouldn't actually say anything wrong. But it's wonderful. So usually, if it's that time when you are just dozed off and you felt your body floating up, that's probably not the real OBEs, the real out-of-body experiences. That's more like this state between being awake and being asleep. But anyway, it's not at all dangerous, even if it really is a real out-of-the-body experience, you go floating off anywhere. You don't have to worry. You know, the alarm system is on, the burglars can't break in, spirits are not going to find your body and go into it and say, oh, it's a vacant place here. So no problem at all, you're perfectly safe. But you know, if you do that a few times, it's a waste of time, so I don't know why people are interested in it. It's much better getting into deep and peaceful meditation. But just sometimes what happens? Could be, probably not, is the answer. For reincarnation, is there a limit of time, location and race? Yeah, there are limits. You've got to be dead before you reincarnate. That's the first limit.
the time after you die until you reincarnate. How long does it take? Location and race? No, it's just sometimes that, you know, what you want to be. So if you had a choice, what race would you be in the next life? What gender would you like to be? What country would you like to live in? So, look at me. I was really stupid in this life. Instead of getting reborn in a nice Buddhist place, I got reborn in England. Cold, no Buddhists around for miles. So I really made a bad choice on that one. It's very lucky being born in a Buddhist country. So number one, if you're going to get reincarnated, get reborn in a nice Buddhist country. And the time, the best time, is when Buddhas are around. But this is a good time now because Buddhism is very, very strong. Location and race, well, that's really up to you. So the causes for getting reincarnated is number one, you want to get reincarnated in that particular place and you have the karmic conditions to get you reincarnated there. So it's, you know, what you want and whether you can actually get there. I usually tell the simile, suppose you want to go to, where do you want to go to? Suppose you want to go to, like, Brazil to watch the carnival. And if you want to go to Brazil, or to get to Brazil, you need two things. You need the money to get there. And also you need to want to get there. And if you've got the money and you want to get there, you'll end up there. So the money is like karma. The wanting to get there is a craving. With the karma and the craving, that's where you get reborn. So you ask yourself, where do you want to get reborn if you do die? I've asked that question of a few people here in Western Australia, and a couple of people would tell me that in their next life, they wanted to get reborn as a dog. They said that, this guy. And I couldn't believe this. So what do you want to get reborn as a dog for? And he said, because I don't like going to work on a Monday mornings and dogs, they just sleep in all day. Have a great life. They play around, they get the best food, and all they need to do is, you know, to get patted every now and again. They don't have any stress, no worries at all. So he said, I want to get reborn as a dog in my next life, in this nice wealthy suburb. And then I told him, he said, well look, if you get reborn as a male dog, here in Perth, after a couple of weeks, they take you to the vet to have the operation. And when he heard that, he said, I don't want to be a dog. So it's what you want to be, that's what you become. So what would you like to be? I always remember when I was a student, I used to read widely. And if any of you have ever read Plato's Republic, you know, Plato, one of the great Greek philosophers, his last chapter in Plato's Republic was talking about his idea of reincarnation. And he's, you know, he said this, that the Greeks believe in reincarnation, but that after you die, you go across the river Styx, S-T-Y-X, in a boat, and then you go to what they call the Elysian Fields. Some of you may have heard these words before. A nice place you can rest and relax until you get reborn again. But he was saying that, and this is the point which I always remember, he said that when you get reborn, you can choose. He said the idiots, the really stupid ones, they're the ones who got reborn as the wealthy, powerful people. And sometimes people like to be wealthy, like to be powerful. And people like Plato were smart enough to say those are the ones who have all the trouble. He said the smart people would always get reborn. It's just in the middle somewhere. Not famous, not too wealthy, but just in the middle so they can enjoy a nice, peaceful life without sort of other people being jealous of you, stealing from you, or putting you down because you're too powerful and famous. And he said, that is the best life to choose. In the middle. Those who want to be famous, those who want to be super wealthy, are idiots. They have a lot of suffering. If you're poor, you have lots of suffering. Somewhere in the middle is the best life. Please remember that. Only idiots want to be super wealthy because they just don't have any friends. They don't have much of a life. They're freaks in society. the ones who can just go around wherever they want, you're not noticed, you've got enough money but not too much. The ones who aren't celebrities, you have a nice life. So I always remember that's very good. Okay. Okay, that's about reincarnation. Is that the question? Oh, sometimes there is a gap between the time you die and before you go and get reincarnated. So sometimes a person dies and they want to hang out to make sure that everything is done properly, first of all. Aren't you interested to see who comes to your cremation and who doesn't? So you can go around and haunt those people and give them a hard time. So a lot of times it takes a while before you go off into your reincarnation. So like most of you, if you died right now, you'd be concerned to make sure that all the loose ends are tied up and everything is okay before you actually go and take your rebirth. So usually wait till your funeral. Funeral's over, everything is okay, bye-bye, I'm off. And it's because there is that time between people dying and getting reborn. That's why they have many ghost stories. And there are many interesting ghost stories of people who have died and haven't yet got reborn. Would you like to hear a ghost story? It don't care if you like it or you're not, because you're going to hear one. Real ghost stories. Okay, what about the one? What's a nice scary one? Okay. This is for those of you who live in Perth, about the ghost at Karakata Cemetery. You know that one? You do? No. There is the biggest cemetery in Perth. It's in this suburb called Karakata. And there's so many gravestones there. It's very old. And many people get cremated there as well. It's one of the three big crematoriums now. And is one of the people I know very well. She's got her own IT business. She's Asian, a devout Buddhist. And being Asian, she's terrified of ghosts. So when she got offered a very lucrative contract to upgrade the IT system at Karakata Cemetery, she didn't know whether she should take it or not. But it was such a profitable deal, she accepted. Which meant she had to go to work in the offices of this cemetery. And many of you have been there. Just as you go in the entrance, they're on the left-hand side, where they do all of the business, all the paperwork, when people get buried or when they get cremated. But she was very careful. She made sure she always arrived late, so there's always other people in the office when she arrived. And she always left early, so she was never left alone. But you know Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it will happen. It was just a Friday afternoon. She was that close to finishing the contract. All she needed to do, a little bit, half an hour work, and print out the documents, you know, the report, to leave for the managers on Monday morning. And that was finished. And she'd been there a couple of weeks, and she thought, it's only an extra half hour. I'll be okay. Never think like that in a cemetery. That's big mistake number one. So for the first time since starting work, she was in the office, alone. At least, she thought she was alone. She finished up the typing. She pressed the print button and went over to the computer, as you do, to check the printout. 60 or 80 pages, looking them through, and then she stopped as the blood drained from her face. Because in her report, there was a page right in the middle which he hadn't typed, which he hadn't printed at all. It was an image of a gravestone with a name engraved on the outside. She knows IT. I never printed that. In the next 5 minutes, she was about 10 kilometers away. She doesn't really remember how that happened. But just, she got in her car and she left. And on Monday morning, they asked her, "Why did you leave the office unlocked? Why is all your papers all over the place?" And she told the story. And they said, and it's still there, the piece of paper that she collected it. Said, "Yeah, that happens here. Especially when everybody leaves on the weekend, when the ghosts have their party." And they said, apparently, that you pull all the chairs out there, tidy up, waiting for a meeting on Monday morning. But on Monday morning, everything's rearranged. Papers are all over the place. Yes, from Monday to Friday, the office workers, they work in the office, but on the weekend, that's ghost time. Do you believe that story? It's true. So they're just ghosts playing around, having a good time, that's all. So anyway, there is a time span, and that's where you get the ghosts from. What about in Jhana Grove? Don't worry. This is a new place. No one has died here yet. There's no ghosts. We don't invite anybody to come on retreat either. You've got to keep 5 precepts. You've got to be a member of the Buddhist Society. And there's no ghosts, as far as I know, who have actually joined up. So you're safe. They can't come. Next question. Sorry about the noise of waterboarding, but it was 4:30. Aren't we supposed to rise with gusto at 4 p.m.? No, apparently, 4 a.m., yeah, there's a couple of people have confessed already. So this person, doesn't know if it was this person, because many of you feel guilty. You all think it's you. So yes, it's good to rise with gusto, but shh, gusto. No, I think it was somebody else at 3 o'clock. I don't know, but who cares anyway. But yeah, be quiet with the water boy. Maybe it wasn't you at all. Maybe it was the ghost. Wanted a cup of tea. Ajahn. Maybe that lady who had the out-of-body experience. Maybe she was turned on the kettle in the out-of-body experience. Actually, I don't want to make anyone scared, because look, seriously, ghosts are terrified of monks. That's absolutely true. So as long as there's a monk around, you're totally safe. Ajahn, as you said in last night's talks, why is it that Buddhists do not try to take the teaching to the Western world? Some do, but not enough. That's why we need more bhikkhunis training everybody to take the teachings. Sometimes I just get sort of so, not surprised, but look, last January I spent a couple of weeks in Sri Lanka. Haven't you got enough monks in Sri Lanka? Why do you have to import them from Australia? It's the same as Singapore. Can't you grow your own? And Malaysia, all these other places. So yeah, it's one of the reasons, but I go to these places and you get big crowds come. You know, thousands of people. In Indonesia, 5,000 people come into talks. I think, just why can other people do that? You know, one of the reasons is, if you're going to teach Buddhism, you've got to learn Buddhism, first of all, and actually get it inside. And when you get it inside, then you can actually explain it in your own words in ways which actually make sense to people. So get these, some of these people, like say in Sri Lanka, they know much more Buddhism than I do. You know, they're Pali experts, and they've read the suttas and the commentaries and the sub-commentaries. They're far more knowledgeable. But, you know, they teach from the books rather than from the heart. And I said that this is the holy book of Buddhism, your heart. So you've got to be virtuous, make sure you are, you know, you practice what you preach, and then you preach, you know, from your heart, from experience, and that is very powerful. So we need more monks and nuns to be well practiced, to keep that virtue. And keeping strong precepts doesn't mean you're sort of this dull, boring person. No, because I know those precepts so well, and they're very compassionate, and they're very easy to live. If you practice your precepts, it actually gives you a lot of happiness and joy and playfulness. That's what the precepts are. The people who are very strict, they're the ones who are afraid of breaking precepts. They don't really know. They're not comfortable, you know, in the robes. Once you're comfortable in the robes, you can have fun. Like anybody else who's very comfortable in their job, they can relax, and they do a good job, and they don't feel to be tight and demanding. You know, like we said, not to be proud, conceited, not to be demanding in nature, easily satisfied, contented. That's what the goal is, and so that's what you should see. So that way that we can have people actually not just teaching what you can read in a book, but teaching from the heart and inspiring people. Yeah, it can be done. And also learning how to give public talks. It's just that ghost story. When you change the tone of your voice. Because who knows what's outside the door. And you can see how to give public talks. It's very easy. You know, just play up, dramatize, be a bit of a comedian or an actor or whatever. And it's very easy to change your voice and just encourage people and entertain people, because entertainment is part of giving a talk, and that's actually part of teaching. I learned that when I was a school teacher. You know, you've got a class of kids in school, you're competing with the TV, because that's a source of entertainment, or the, you know, the laptop. So, you know, you have to entertain, but at the same time, convey the message. And a little bit of entertainment, really actually people are listening. I often say on a Friday night talk, people are waiting for the next joke, and while they're waiting, they're aware. So they're actually listening to what I'm saying. And I look at those on a Friday night in Nolamara, and when they start getting bored, you can tell that because their eyes go down onto the floor. That's the time for a joke. Wakes them up. And then they're paying attention again. Very simple technique. So anyway, I don't know why more people don't do that. And the nice thing is you don't have to be a monk or a nun to be a teacher. There's great lay people who do teaching as well. So, you know, you go out there and just go out there and help. It'll be beautiful. And then I can retire and live a nice, easy life. Ajahn, is it true that Jesus was in India for a period of time? I reckon that Jesus lived in India. Why not? Okay, this is a Jesus lived in India example. Philo of Alexandria. He, 4 AD, so I don't know how many years ago, 2007 years ago, he wrote this history of Alexandria, which was a chief city of what we now know as Egypt. That's the place where Mark Antony and Cleopatra lived. That was the head city. And he said in this city of Alexandria, 4 BC, there was a monastery. A monastery where the monks, and they had nuns as well, separated by a big wall. They had nuns as well, it says. They had shaved heads, totally bald, brown robes, vegetarians, and they kept like a Sabbath. They did something every week. And when I first read that, that could only mean, they were celibate as well, only mean one thing, that was Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns. No one else was vegetarian. No one else sort of shaved their heads totally. Even the Christian monks, they just did a little bit of their head, not total shave, brown robes, the Sabbath, you know, the Poya days, the moon days. So it was obvious to me it was Buddhist monks. They were called Theraputai. And I know enough about Pali, Sanskrit, and just the way the words change when they go from country to country. Theraputai, Thera, you know, Theravada. P's and V's change. V's and B's, first of all, change. Varanasi, Benares. V's and B's. B's and P's change. Buddha. What's the word for Buddha in Thai? Puta. Putajau. B's and P's and V's are interchangeable. So, from Theraputai to Theravudai. And it's not that far from Theravudai to Theravada. That was a Theravada monastery in Egypt. Four AD. And Philo said, there were thousands, not a few, but thousands of these monks further down in Lower Egypt. And when I heard that, I thought that never made sense until later on it sort of clicked. Because Lower Egypt was India. That was the way the trade route came. The main trade route was not overland. From the port of Soparaka, just outside of modern Mumbai, a very famous port, you read that, stories of that port in the Jataka tales, the ships would leave there and they would go across the Gulf of Iran, or whatever it's called, Persian Gulf. One of the places they would stop was Aden. Its old name in Greece was, I think, Felix Arabia or something. No, Fortunate Port. An ancient port. Other people at that time recorded in Aden there was a huge number of Greeks, Egyptians, Jewish people, and Indians. The four major groups of people in Aden at that time. Of course, they were just traders. You know, when you have expats, you put your people in the destination to make sure everything is okay. And then from there, across, up the Red Sea, and there was Ptolemy Philadelphus. That was about 50 or 60 BC. He actually built a port there to take the trade from India. And in that port, that city, I forget what it was called now, but there are, to this day, archaeologists have found headstones, gravestones of the Indians who died with Dhammachakas on them, with the three refuge, Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dhammang Saranangacchami, Sangha Saranangacchami, from that age. There were Buddhists. This is hard stone evidence. Buddhists in that port in Lower Egypt at that time. And from there the trade went overland, you know, to the Nile and up the Nile to Alexandria. And from there, Alexandria, that was the hub, like a Singapore, okay? From there it went all over Europe. And from Europe to Alexandria and back into India. And that was the main trade route. And we don't know much about Alexandria because there was an earthquake and a flood which flooded most of the town. But we do know that there were the Buddhist monks there. And when he said there's more thousands of these back down the Nile, they were saying over in that port city and further away actually in India itself. Now the reason I say that, if the Theraputai were Buddhist monks at 4 BC, and according to the story which I heard in school, because you know you had to learn Christianity, that Jesus' family fled Palestine to go to Egypt, where he grew up. And they don't say where in Egypt, sort of, you know, his mum and dad and the son went to, but of course, if ever you are a refugee, you go to the capital city. Why? Because that's where the work is. So it's almost certain that Joseph and Mary and their kids, remember, he wasn't sort of the only kid, he had brothers, I think James, brother of Jesus. So I don't know what that means about the virgin birth, because he has to be twice a virgin. He had a brother. I never figured that one out. But anyway, the family would have gone to Alexandria, and if that fellow was interested in religion, and this was a famous religious place in Alexandria, he would have gone there. He would have talked to those monks. You know, we're putting Jesus and a Buddhist monastery in the same town at the same time together. Chronologically proved. So if he was interested, and he got interested in Buddhism, where would you go next? Just suppose that he went to that monastery, got interested. At that particular time, the emperor of India was Kanishka, and his capital was in Kashmir, in Srinagar. That's where India was ruled, from Kashmir. And again, with the emperor would be the best monasteries. He was a Buddhist, a very famous Buddhist. There in Kashmir would be all the famous monasteries, because you always tend to go, the famous monks tend to go to the capitals. That's where, you know, you get the sort of the prestige. Many of the great monasteries in Sri Lanka were around Colombo, Mahalagama, and what's the other place? I forget now anyway, but Kandaboda. That's not far from Colombo, is it? Anyway, I forget my geography of Sri Lanka. But anyway, the biggest monasteries would be around the central area. That would be their headquarters, because that's the center of the empire. So, now these are assumptions, but they are, you know, compelling. If he did go to India, he would go to Kashmir. That would have been the place he went to. And, of course, are there any records of that? And, of course, you know there was. There was an adventurer in 1955 or 60, I forget what he was, some count from Eastern Europe, who went trekking in the Himalayas and broke his leg up in Ladakh. And as he broke his leg in Ladakh, there was no other place to go. They couldn't get airlifted out in those days. So he hung out in the local Buddhist monastery in Leh. And being a bit of a scholar, the abbot allowed him to mess around in the library. So he was looking at ancient manuscripts, and that's where he found a story of, Issa. Issa, this Buddhist from Palestine, who had come over to learn Buddhism in Kashmir, because Ladakh is right next to Kashmir, who came to actually learn Buddhism in Kashmir, and went back to Palestine. And at that time he was a great healer, had a few psychic powers, but they didn't like him in Palestine, and they say they crucified him, but he survived and came back to Kashmir, where he lived a long life, you know, of healing, and eventually died. And after he died, they interred him in Kashmir. And of course, if you know, seen the BBC documentaries, there is the tomb of Jesus in Kashmir. And there was a BBC documentary which investigated that tomb and asked, you know, is this the same guy? And the only interesting thing is that there is a metal footprint at that shrine. It's supposed to be of this, I think they called him Joseph or Jehoseph. Jehoseph or something. Issa, very easy, that's, you know, the Jesus in the Sanskrit. And Jehoseph, I think that's also very easy to see how that would happen. That's how they would call them there. Oh, look, now when I went to Thailand, a good example. One of the monks, Ajahn Kawesako, he's quite a well-known monk, the Japanese monk, his name was Shibahashi. Okay, now how can a Thai person like Ajahn Chah say Shibahashi? So what you do, the closest word to that. So the closest word to Issa was, to Jesus was Issa. The closest word, you know, in the Ladakh area was Jehoseph or whatever. The closest word to Shibahashi was Si-Bart-Ha-Sip, which any Thai would recognize as their currency of a baht is 4 baht 50. And that was his nickname. That's what Ajahn Chah would call him when he was alive. Now here comes, you know, $4.50. And that sort of name stuck. They had Ajahn Amaro. He's now taken over Amarawati. No, his name was Jeremy. And the nearest name for Jeremy was Jeremy, Numman Jeremy, which is like this axle grease. So even these days, you know, he sort of sometimes writes his letters, you know, best of luck, axle grease. Because that would... So when you actually go to different cultures, sometimes your name changes slightly just to make it sort of easy for them. So it's very likely that that was, you know, the Jesus. And anyway, the footprint. No other... what cultures, what religions have footprints as symbols? And that's dinky-dye Buddhism. You have Buddha footprints all over the place. Supposed to have a Buddha footprint in Suripada, Adam's Peak in Sri Lanka. There's so many Buddha footprints in Thailand. Now, whether they're real or not, I don't know, but it's an ancient symbol of Buddhism. And there's a footprint, okay, of this Jesus. But interestingly, it's got scars on it. And they wondered what that footprint with scars on is. And they showed that those exactly, it's on the foot, exactly where those scars would be and what you'd expect if nails had been put through the feet. Consistent with the footprint of someone who's been crucified. Da da da. That's the final nail in the coffin, so to speak. That Jesus did not live in India. Maybe he did. So there's compelling evidence for it. Why not? So anyway, that is the evidence. You make up your own mind. Anyway, I better carry on here, otherwise I'll be sent to India. The Metta Sutta says, or crucified or whatever. I've only done 4 quizzes, heaps ago. The Metta Sutta says, do not hold fixed views. I have a fixed view which causes me a lot of unhappiness. I said metta and tried to challenge a view, but I just hate men. I blame them for wars and domination, especially when I watch the news. Insight would free me from this miserable view. Please help, bitter and twisted. No, look, who started the Falklands War? Margaret Thatcher. She did. So it's not just men start all the wars, there's a few women start the wars as well. So anyway, a fixed view. The way we chant it here? The fixed view was the translation they used in England when they translated the Metta Sutta. It sounds nice, but it's not actually an accurate translation. That's why I think it was Ajahn Chattamala did this translation when he was here and changed it to false views. And that's much more accurate to the Pali. So it's a false view, not a fixed view. And there are many wrong views, like men men start all the wars. So remember, don't hate a group of people, a race, a gender, or like people of certain sexual orientation like gays. You should never hate a group. At the very least, you know, just hate individuals of that group who really sort of you mess around. But, you know, don't paint everybody with the same brush. You know, there are some politicians who are really, really nice. I'm sure there were some SS guards, you know, who were very, very nice. I know one of them, you know, from history. You know, this fellow called Schultz. For those of you who remember Hogan's Heroes on the TV, he was one of my favorite characters. He was this guard of this POW camp in Germany on a TV show. And when any of these POWs were messing around, he put his hand over his eyes and say, I see nothing, I see nothing. And I used him as my sort of model when I became an abbot. So if I see any of the monks messing around or the Anagarikas, I put my hand, I see nothing, I see nothing. That's great CEO way of dealing with the problems. So no, don't characterize everybody as being the same, like all Christians, all Muslims are terrorists, you know, all sort of, all politicians are corrupt or whatever, all sort of English people are whingers or whatever. So that way, so at least be wise and don't think that all criminals are evil. So sometimes you see these people, it changes your ideas of life. So challenge that with a bit of experience. So it's rotten, you know, to live with hate of people you don't know. You know, all those other men you've never seen. All those other sort of people working in Guantanamo Bay or SS officers or other people you feel are just all tied with the same brush. And when actually you see all those others, you think, actually there's some very nice people there trying to do their best. Anyway, what is Buddha's position on energy healing? Is it beneficial for practicing meditation? Is this healing energy metta? Yeah, it's nice to hear a few things every now and again, but look, what's the point of healing when you're going to die anyway? It's only temporary healing, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, that's one of my problems once. I did this chanting for people in the hospital. This family invited me over because their old father was dying. So can we do some chanting for him? And so they actually never said why they wanted me to do the chant. So I did this very, very strong chanting, and it got better. And they scolded me afterwards. So we didn't want him to get better. You know, we were ready to let him go. Everything was arranged. And now you come along and get him alive again. Did the wrong chanting. So it does work. You can do healing energy, but you go, oh, do you want healing energy now or the other? So, yeah, it does work. But you know, in the end, the best healing energy is wisdom. So instead of healing the body, heal the mind. Heal the emotions. Because the body is, you know, it's a bit of a waste of time. It's going to die. It's only temporary. You heal the mind, and that's forever. When there arises a desire to be loved, is that just an indicator there needs to be more love and kindness towards oneself? Of course. Everyone likes to be loved. And you find someone who's very nice to you, and then they go away. They leave, or you leave. They can't be with you forever. But there's one person who is going to be with you forever. You. So that person, your closest companion, your partner forever, your real soulmate, you, that's the one to develop love towards. So remember tonight, say, when you say goodnight, you say, do it properly, get your hand and stroke yourself there. You've had such a hard day today, meditating all day, you know, going without your evening meal, and just you're trying and all those aches and pains and the difficulties and frustrations. Yeah, you're all right, I love you. I know you're stupid and will never get enlightened, not for this next 100 lifetimes, but you're still okay. So love yourself and stroke yourself, whatever, I don't know. Would you recommend scanning the body at all? Yes, scanning the body is very good if you're in hospital and can afford it. It's very expensive. Is that what you mean? Let's go back again. Oh, I mean meditating. Okay, I'm just letting it be while being with the breath. Okay, so basically, just let things be with the breath. Because you scan your body, you might find an ache here, an ache there. So it's much better just to leave the body alone. Just might come short set. I see nothing, just the breath. And that way the body will disappear and you'll be fine. Scanning the body is good for relaxation. And it's good if you know get very restless, you can actually scan the body so you can see different parts of the body. It means you stop thinking because you can't be scanning and thinking at the same time. So that's very good. But you know, the best thing is just doing nothing. I am often hurt and offended by people, especially those close to me who say I am oversensitive. How do I overcome this? Well, if you're often hurt and offended by people, then you are oversensitive. It's obvious, isn't it? So why do you allow them to hurt you? You know, why do you allow other people's bad karma and stupidity to affect you? It should be hurting them. You haven't done anything wrong. So look, the way to do that, they call you a pig. And then you think, why do they call me a pig? I'm not a pig. It's not right to call me a pig. And then you realize they've called you a pig 3 more times. Every time you remember it, you're allowing them to call you a pig again. So someone has hurt you. They cheated you. Every time you remember that, they're cheating you again, hurting you one more time. Why on earth do you let them do that? So me, they can hurt me once, and that's it. You're karma, nothing to do with me. You call me a pig, you hit me, you're going to suffer for that. You know, if you hit a good monk, you're in trouble. I just let them, I don't sort of worry about it, because that's their karma. So don't get hurt and offended by people, especially those who are close to you, who say you're oversensitive. You know, just let it in one ear, out the other, in the present moment. You don't carry the past, and then you find that you are sensitive in the right areas. You're sensitive to let go, to loving kindness, to peace. But you're not sensitive in the sense you carry all the pain of the past. Be like that lotus I said this morning. They can say rotten things to you, and it just drops off without staining or wetting you at all. And you do that, you do more meditation, and you'll be great, because meditation is the snake oil which gets rid of all those problems. Wow. Aha, this is more like it. A joke for Ajahn Brahm. Two men meet on the street, one after the other. Hi, how are you? The other replies, I'm fine, thanks. It's a good start. I haven't read this, I don't know what this is. And how's your son? Is he still unemployed? Yes, he is. But he is meditating now. Meditating? What's that? I don't know, but it's better than sitting around and doing nothing. That's quite good. I haven't heard that before. That's funny. Well done. I keep that one. Better than sitting around and doing nothing. Good. This retreat centre feels like heaven. Yes, I agree. It means you died. Thank you. Well, the only way you can go to heaven is you're dead. So if it feels like heaven, you better check your pulse. Thank you for giving us a chance to be here. Could you please talk about chakras? Was this taught by the Buddha? Can one person's negative energy be passed on to another? If so, how does one protect themselves from that? Okay, you can only take on their bad energy if you let them. Now, one way you take on another person's bad energy is when they call you a pig and you get upset by it. You've now taken on their bad energy. So why not take on people's good energy? Oh, you're just such a wonderful meditator. Take that on board. Oh, yes, give me more. But we don't accept praise. We only accept sort of negativity. So that's why we have opened ourselves up to accept other people's anger, ill will, stupidity. That's why we get offended. So close up that chakra, which receives bad energy, and open up the one which receives good energy. So you see someone having a wonderful time, or they're opening up the door for someone, they're helping someone out, they're doing a good deed. Open up that chakra to accept the goodness of the world. And then you find that you are opening up the beautiful chakras. These are energy entrances and exits. And I'm not talking about, you know, the chakras here and the chakras here. I'm the chakra of negativity, the chakra of positivity. Open that up. So whenever you see someone doing a beautiful act, an act of kindness, generosity, softness, just draw all that energy in, share it. Any bad energy, I see nothing. Yeah, so anyway, that's a quick one. At the monks' monastery, women are welcome to stay. Now there's a change of abbots at the nuns' monastery. Will men be allowed to stay? Or will it remain a feminist enclave? No, it's going to remain a feminist enclave. No, of course it's not. Yes, men can stay there, but you have to work hard. Ooh, there's so much to be done over there. That's why all the men like to stay at Bodhidharma Monastery. They have a very easy time over there. So, yeah, monks will be allowed to stay over there, as long as they're willing to work hard. Because the nuns have got a huge amount of work to do over there. It's a new monastery and it's growing. It's not like Bodhinyana Monastery, been there for 27 years, so all the infrastructure is in place. You've got nice halls, nice kitchens, you don't have to do very much. And who did all that work? Monks like me, yeah. Did all that work so you can come and stay there. So now it's your turn. So if you go there, go and offer to help out, to work. They have got the plans to do the lay men's accommodation, so yeah. Men will be allowed in there, just like women are allowed in Bodhinyana Monastery. But you have to behave. Of course you do. At the moment you get more sort of people staying in Bodhinyana because it's there, it's finished, and so it's comfortable. If in this life we are Buddhists, are there any possibility to be born as a Christian or a Muslim in the next life? Of course, there's all sorts of possibilities. So, sometimes people, they said, I'm a Buddhist, that means I have to be a vegetarian, I can't take alcohol. So they think, okay, next life. Just one life, so I can have hamburger and a glass of beer. Some people think like that, you know. I think somebody in Singapore said that. They said the reason they're a Christian rather than a Buddhist is because they can, you know, go out to the pub and they can have steaks. That's what it's told me in Singapore. That's really just so bizarre. You know, just if that's the reason why you choose one religion over another, you haven't got much spiritual depth. But that's what they said. So, yeah, if you're silly, you can reborn like that. If you're really depraved. What to do when nimitta starts appearing before the five senses turn off? You know the answer. All together now. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Yeah. At any time use that. So the nimitta starts. So if it's too early for the nimittas, the mind will choose and the nimittas will fade away by themselves. If it is the right time, the nimitta will stay. You don't have to do anything. You just relax and just see what happens. If you do something, then you're really killing the nimitta. In the time of the Buddha, many people became enlightened. This is in contrast to our age, where actually there are more Buddhists than there were then. So, was there something missing in translation or through time, or is it a sign of spiritual decline of our society? How come Buddha's teachings does not seem to have as profound as was described in the sutras, profound an effect as was described in the sutras? Please explain. Yeah, I want you to explain that. In a time of the Buddha, you give a talk like this, and 6 people become enlightened, 100 people become stream winners. I've been teaching this retreat for 4 or 5 days. What's wrong with you guys? That's interesting, isn't it? What's wrong? One of the reasons is, in those days, there was very simple teachings, and people really listened, because their mind wasn't so clogged with information. And we've got such an information overload. You know about Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, Christianity, Islam. You've got so much information in your brain, it's just confused. So that's one of the reasons why I keep it very simple. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Stop all this thinking, get some stillness, get some emptiness, so at last this clogged up mist of thoughts and ideas in your brain can disappear, so you can actually see things. Remember, in those days, there wasn't much education. There wasn't no TV with information channels. There wasn't so much newspapers and books and stuff like that. So people's minds were very simple. Simple enough to see clearly. One of our troubles is we know too much. And I say that not because I don't like knowledge. I say that actually for seeing things, you have to see things which you've never seen before. Go way beyond your perceptual frameworks caused by knowledge. That's why some of the sayings which I've said, never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Too often knowledge stands in the way of truth. This can't be true because I told it was not true. We believe others. We believe the books. We believe our knowledge. We trust that. And that stops us seeing, which is one of the reasons I'm teaching you to really empty out your minds. To get into these jhanas where there's no thoughts left, no concepts, totally free, blissed out, peaceful. And then you've got a chance. You've got a great chance of seeing the Dhamma. But without that emptiness, it's too difficult. There was this wonderful simile told by Ajahn Chah in the forest monasteries of Thailand. Because there were forests, we'd spend so many hours sweeping the leaves off the paths. Every day for a couple of hours. And after you swept the paths, because the sand was very white, it stood out like silver white ribbons snaking through the jungle. And because it was white, then even at night time, if there was a snake, scorpion, centipede on the path, you have a good chance of seeing it. That's why we swept the paths for. It was just practical so we wouldn't get bitten by all these animals who looked at your toes as if there were dinner. So, when I started sweeping, like many monks would sweep, you'd just do one section, you'd turn around and a leaf had fallen on it. And being a Westerner, you're a perfectionist, you'd actually go back again and sweep that leaf off. And the Thais, it's only one leaf, you know, that's good enough, go forward. But Ajahn Chah would also notice that. He said, when one leaf falls in an empty, clean, well-swept path, it stands out. You can see it clearly. But when a leaf falls in a forest of millions of leaves, you can't even notice it. And he said, when an idea or an insight falls, and there's so many other insights there, you can't understand it. But when an insight falls in an empty, free mind, like a well-swept path, then you can see and understand it. So sweep the paths, first of all. Empty the mind. Keep it still. Then when insight falls, you can understand it. Otherwise, the insight falls in a whole forest floor of thousands and millions of insights. You can't understand it. No more than you can see a leaf which has fallen in the middle of the forest. Fascinating. A great insight by Ajahn Chah. Ajahn, with the paranoia relating to noise sound present within the retreat, maybe the right time to talk about Ajahn Chah's teaching. It's not the sound that disturbs you, you disturb the sound. Indeed. So it's not the complaints which disturb you, it's you are disturbing the complaining. Whoever wrote that. These things are alive. Yeah, it's always a tough one, but remember what I was saying, everybody makes noise. So don't just complain about others, you are making noise as well. So try and be kind, but also be sensitive. So because you don't want to be disturbed, you don't disturb others. And make that a practice of mindfulness, to be able to open the doors. It takes more time, but you've got time here. To make sure that you don't knock the tool with your knees. Whatever else you do. I make noises too, but I try my very best to be as silent as I possibly can. So as long as you've got the right intention, as long as you're trying, well done. And you make mistakes, you know, you'll drop something and wake people up, but that's par for the course. So leave it alone. If someone disturbs you, just be kind to them. It must be, if they disturbed you, another way of looking at it, that must be you're paying back your old karma. If you've been woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning because somebody has turned on the electric kettle, it must be, there's always cause and effect, it must be that the last retreat you did something the same or something the worst, and now you have to get your karmic retribution by you being woken up. So the next time you're disturbed by a door slamming, just think, oh dear, I probably slammed the door sometime and disturbed someone else. So now that's one thing which has been paid off, one debt which is gone. So thank you, whoever slammed that door, for making me free of the karmic causes of me slamming the door before. Whatever else, think something like that anyway and just go to sleep and stop thinking about it. How do we stop saliva accumulating in our mouth? That is a big problem with some meditators. And those people have a real big problem with that. The solution is actually to get one of these machines which they have in the dentist surgery. They put this little tube in there and they suck out the saliva so you can meditate without any saliva coming out. It's got sucking, sucking, sucking. That's extreme. So the best thing is just don't worry about it. Every time you start thinking about it, like now, can you feel your saliva now you're thinking about it? Now it comes out more than ever. Every time you think about it, you make a problem out of it. So just let it go, think of something else, go to the breath or whatever, and you find the saliva is natural, and it just goes down the throat, doesn't come out at all, it balances itself. When you think about it, it becomes unbalanced and a problem. If you take your mind away from it, everything settles down. Doesn't that tell you something about the when you control things, you mess things up, you interfere? So that way there's... If it's not that, it means you're thinking about breakfast or you're thinking about food. So that's the only reason why saliva comes out. Imagine just... Are you hungry? You haven't eaten for so many hours. What would you like to eat? Can you imagine just your favorite food, the thing that you would be eating now if you didn't have these damn 8 precepts to keep? What would you be eating now? Can you imagine it? Can you see it? Can you smell it? Now saliva's coming out. That's what happens. You're letting your mind wander off on food. Anyway, Master Ajahn, I'm finding the retreat very hard to enjoy. I want to get married one day, but I must travel in Asia to look for a job. The doctor confirmed my testosterone is 2.5 times more than a normal man. You have not had sex for 40 years, and after 3 days, I am dying. Wonderful! This is one of those joke questions. It's the same handwriting as the fart story yesterday. People have great time over here. So this retreat is very hard to withdraw, but it's good for you. You want to get married one day, take my advice. Don't. You must travel in Asia a lot for your job. Wonderful. That's stopping you getting into big trouble. What happens when you get married? They put rings on you. They're called handcuffs. You're not free anymore. And you might find it's wonderful at the very beginning. I know this person, they told me that, that's actually quite sweet. When they were going out together, they would always hold hands. And they've been married for 10 or 15 years, and they still hold hands. Isn't that sweet? But before it was out of love. This time they hold hands out of self-defense. Why are you laughing? Because it's true. So the doctor confirmed my testosterone is 2.5 times more than a normal amount. You have injections against that. We can give you some injections. You have not had sex for 40 years, and after 3 days I am dying. See how happy I am without sex for 40 years. Would you like to be here? You know, sometimes you used to have those advertisements, you know, when you was on TV, when I used to watch TV, of before and after. You know, the before, you know, you hadn't used the right toothpaste, and no one went near you. And after you used the right toothpaste, everything you ever wanted in life just came to you. So you see, you know, you are the before man, I'm the after man. So this could be you. So whoever wrote that is finding it hard to enjoy. You want to get married one day, but you must travel in Asia a lot for my job. That's like me. I travel a lot in Asia for my job. I've just been to Indonesia. I'm going to Singapore next week for my job. So I travel a lot in Asia for my job too. Wonderful. So what you need to do is actually ordain. Become a monk. And that will solve all your problems. Thank you. How could someone practicing meditation up to a certain level still become Christian, while through meditation he can see the truth, such as rebirth? It doesn't make sense. Someone still keeps himself a Christian after knowing the truth. Human beings are so strange. Sometimes on the outside they say they're a Christian, but on the inside they're a Buddhist. I know a lot of people like that. You know, they call themselves Chris Buddhists. There's something to do with that, because you know, inside they know that sort of, you know, that this is the tradition or this is the truth which really resonates with them. But for some reason or another, maybe their parents or maybe their job or whatever, they just go through the motions. I remember going to teach, this was Ajahn Pasma got me to do this, that the Christian, it was Catholics in Pattaya, they had a little retreat center. They wanted a Buddhist to teach a retreat on a weekend, to learn some meditation. So I wanted, and actually Ajahn Pasna got me to do this. I owed him a favor, so I went down. I wasn't looking forward to it, but I taught them meditation. And in interview times, all these Christian Thai Christian women, they came up and they said, I wanted to make a donation. I said, what do you want to make a donation for? You know, Tambun. I said, look, don't tell the pastor. I'm actually Buddhist. I'm only here because I get free education, you know, free medical, and my son will go to sort of college or university in the West. Once my kids finish their education, I'm going back to being a Buddhist. That's no exaggeration. That's what they said to me. But don't tell the pastor. And of course, I tell everybody. And so they're all Buddhists, but, you know, on the outside, they were practicing Christianity for the social benefits of it. And many people have said in Singapore, one of the reasons why people become Christians in Singapore is because of the social benefits. You know, for fellowship, and sometimes even for job preferences. That's actually true sometimes. So, be true to your understanding, and if you really, you know, if you quack like a duck or walk like you're a duck, you're a duck. So if you quack like a Buddhist and walk like a Buddhist, you're a Buddhist. So just be honest to yourself. I better go quickly. Thanks for fixing the sound. Did I hear you correctly in saying that you can sign checks on the BSWA account? No, I can't. The checks are signed by our, was it the treasurer or the committee members? So they sign the checks. No, we just use them. You can also sign for credit card purchases. No, we don't sign, but, you know, you get PIN numbers. So we don't sign. I'm just judging, just seeking a better understanding of how you understand the Vinaya. Yeah, it's a difficult one, but we don't sign the checks. We try the very, very, very best to try and do as little as possible, but the convenience and practicalities, because we can't get the treasurer always being in our monastery, not even every once a week. In fact, we're having trouble now because the signatories for our Buddhist Society haven't been changed yet. And we had the AGM about almost 6 weeks ago now. And so I mean, just last week, you know, one of the bookkeepers said we hadn't paid up our phone bill for about 6 weeks and they were going to cut us off. Because, you know, sometimes if you're a society, it's really difficult. You know, you have to have two signatories, and to change everything over, sometimes it is somebody away on holiday. You need all the four signatories or six signatories, and it gets very complicated sometimes. But we try and do our best. If the words of the chanting has no value, why did the Buddha chant specific chants for specific situations? Is it scientific to discount the possibility, even though science has not made a study into this field? That in the time of the Buddha, they'd only do the chanting because it was a way of remembering the suttas. So these were actually reminding yourself of what was actually taught because there was no books or CDs or iPods, so you had to remember it yourself. So the chanting was a way of learning by heart what the Buddha taught. It was only later, you know, it gained a sort of a mystic quality to it, and basically that was because of some of the Vedas. You know, the ancient Indian chants which were there at the time of the Buddha also had that sort of mystical quality. But the Buddha was not a superstitious person. And look, quite frankly, I get into trouble. Now, one of the reasons I get into trouble is I'm quite honest to what I think, and sometimes you destroy people's superstitions and they get angry at you. But look at the Pirit chant in Sri Lanka, you know, all night. And I couldn't believe it the first time I saw that. You know, just how, it's actually the Buddha said, don't do it. Specifically said in the Vinaya, don't chant sort of in an unnatural voice. And the chant, which would usually take you 15 minutes, takes about 3 hours. You know, you do the Namo Tassa, and he goes, na. Now you're laughing, but that's actually what they do. I had to, because they invited me in to do this, and I had to sort of restrain myself from laughing. Is this real? But that's a ceremony, it's a culture. And you should always question, what are you doing that for? So chanting does have a power because of what people understand or believe, but a lot of it goes too far. So we should be, instead of chanting, do some more meditation or study or do some compassionate, kind work. Sometimes it's too much chanting in the world. Would it be possible to move the morning chanting to 6, here we go, chanting again, to 6:35 a.m. so it won't break the morning meditation in case one of us is close to enlightenment? I don't know if you want to move it to 6:35 just before breakfast or 6 o'clock. I don't know, sometimes these schedules, they just make themselves. And sometimes I get the schedule, that's good enough for me. 6:35? Who thinks it should be 6:35? Put your hand up. Who thinks it should be 6 o'clock? Put your hand up. Who thinks we shouldn't have chanting at all? 3, 4. You're just all boring, just not really interested. Okay, we just keep it on as usual then. For me, it appears that as the breath becomes less prominent, the heartbeat is very noticeable. This is an important question. Should I shift my attention to the heartbeat, or is there a way to let it fade away so I can know it without feeling it? It's the same way you described the breath. Yeah, the heartbeat is one of the problems in meditation because it's something, if you focus on it, it will be disturbing. It will never disappear. If it disappears, you're in big trouble. Heart stops. So that's one of the problems. The breath can disappear, but not the heart. So because of that, try just to put the attention away from the heartbeat onto the breathing so you don't focus on it. And sometimes people do, they get into that habit of focusing on the heartbeat, and it just really affects the meditation. You can't get very deep that way. So just leave it alone. Let the heart do the beating and you just focus on the breath instead. You talked about being kind to me, if you're saying good morning to me, but in meditation you talked about vanishing, no more me. So when we are kind to ourselves, will we reinforce the illusion of self? Okay, what you can say to yourself as you go to bed tonight, say, get lost to me. No, there is time and place. When you're going to bed, you're still there. So say good night to the thing which is still there. Be kind. Even the Buddha was kind to beings, and there was no one there, but he was still kind to the nothingness. So that's why I think some time ago, people said, how should we address you, Ajahn Brahm? And so I said, the correct term to address me is your emptiness. I was only joking, but that stuck. So every now and again, someone sends me emails, your emptiness, they call me, his emptiness. So when you say goodnight to yourself, say, goodnight, your emptiness. And be kind to the emptiness within you. So you can still say good, it works. So don't be philosophical when you're going to bed, otherwise you never get to sleep. Thank you for pointing out in your first talk that gender should not be an issue in Buddhist meditation practices. Yes. About monastic life, I've been told that nuns have to uphold a lot more precepts than monks, and women can only be ordained once, whereas men can do so multiple times. Can you please explain this apparent gender bias? Yeah, look. How many precepts do you have to keep? 8. I have to keep 227. That's why I'm on a higher seat than you are. The nuns have to keep even more precepts than me. That's why they're even higher. She's got more cushions than I have. So the more precepts makes you higher. It is gender inequality. I demand more precepts for the monks. Women can only be ordained once, where men can do so multiple times, because women, once they make their mind up, that's it. We men, should we ordain? Let's go back again. No, I want to be there. So it shows the superiority of the women's mind. I got out of that one, I hope. I'm going to be hit by some men afterwards.
dear Ajahn, should we advise our children? Shouldn't we advise our children? Isn't it fault-finding? Please explain. How many times do you find fault with your children? And how many times do you praise them and express your love and respect for them? That's another serious problem, because what most people, children, hear is that you don't like them. They're not good enough. They should do better. Their room should be tidier. They should work harder at school. They should be more respectful. They should do this. If you listen objectively to how you speak to your kids, you find there are so many put-downs. And there's very, very few. I really appreciate you. You're very kind. I'm so lucky to have you as my son, my daughter. That's one of the problems. We don't respect each other, our kids. You know, in married life, it's the same. How many times do you say, I'm just so lucky to have known you and met you. You're such a great partner. You're really good. I really care for you. And how many times? You're late! So how many times have I told you, to pick your teeth? How many times have I told you to, take the rubbish out or whatever? This is the way we talk to each other. It's so totally dysfunctional. Because we're always finding fault with each other. And do you want to live in a marriage like that? So don't wait for your partner to change. You change. If you're going to find fault, balance that with 7 things of praise, respect and value. And then find fault. It's called the sandwich method. And I've said that many times before. So yeah, you can advise your children. You can find fault with them. But couch it in respect and value. So your kids know you really do love them. By praising them. Building them up. Motivating them. That's basic motivational psychology. And then you can actually give them a bit of advice. And then it's seen in perspective. Yeah, mum and dad really values me. I'm trying. But, they're giving me a bit of advice. It's not a put down. It's not that, here they go again. How many times do I have to listen to this? The advice is then valued. So please, listen to how you talk to one another and you'll find out why it's hard to have relationships and why it is hard for kids actually to grow up. I'm surprised that kids do so well. With all that they get criticized at home for not being good enough, criticized at school for not being smart enough, criticized at parties for not being beautiful enough. Gee, there's just so much criticism goes on. I really wonder how people survive. And then someone comes along and says, actually, you're good enough as you are. I really value you. You're just such a nice person. And what do? You go and marry them. Because it's so rare to find some people who care and respect you. Yeah, I think you've got the point. Thank you for all the inspiring talks and instructions. Could you please provide more detail about the levitating monk that spoke to God, e.g. which sutta? I would like to read more about this when I go home. Rohitasa. Rohitasa was the monk. I think that's in the Digha Nikaya, isn't it? It's Rohitasa anyway. R-O-H-I. I think it's in the Sangyutta. Rohitasa. I'll try and find that for you. What you said this morning has any connection to the Lotus Sutra and the Mahayana? Nope. Except Lotus. Why are some monks spiritual leaders in other Buddhist denominations? Why are some monks or spiritual leaders in other Buddhist denominations allowed to get married and have families, e.g. in Zen Buddhism? That was because historically the Meiji Restoration, about 150 years ago, was that right, 150, 200 years ago? The Buddhist monks in Japan were becoming too influential and powerful. And so the emperor just wanted to limit their power. Just like many religions have got a lot of power, in Burma, in Thailand, still the Sangha is quite influential. And so the emperor, just politics, wanted to limit the power of the Sangha. And so he ordered the monks to get married. Or, he disrobed them or execute them or something. And they did the same in Korea as well. And this was a powerful emperor. The monks had no choice. They had to leave or get married. But some of them, they went up into the mountains, away from everybody. Very harsh, remote, ascetic. They survived and they kept up the monastic tradition, especially in Korea.
But most of them, the monastic orders were decimated because the rulers forced them to get married, and that's why we have the married monks today. It was politics.
Last question. Okay. If we make our own hell realm, are some acts inevitable hell realms? For example, killing an arahat. You know, arahats are very hard to kill. They've got psychic powers. They know you're coming. So it must be very, very difficult to do that. First of all, you've got to find an arahat, which is pretty hard to find. And sometimes, if you do find them, they're just so soft and so nice and cuddly. How can you kill something like that? Just, oh, can't do it. So it's very unlikely to be able to do that. So some acts, inevitable hell realms, yes, but it's very, very, very rare. So most of the hell realms, yeah, you make yourself. And what do we call that? Guilt. You feel you need to be punished. So you make a realm where you punish yourself. And that happens in this life. I don't know. Look, this is a good story because it affects your meditation. That story of one of the nuns years ago staying the retreat period in Bodhinyana Monastery. Meditation was really taking off. I was just very excited for her. She got incredible, beautiful nimittas, but she couldn't get into the jhana. And I asked her, what's going on? And then she let loose what was going on. She said, I don't think I deserve such happiness. And that was the one reason why she wouldn't go further into jhanas and enlightenment. She had this negativity brainwashed into her, I don't know for how long. But yeah, she can get so far, but she doesn't really deserve to be happy. Guilt. And please, that may be an obstacle for your meditation and your life. Well, some of the reasons why women or men, they have these relationships and they should be going perfectly. They destroy their own happiness. And why? Because they think they don't deserve to be happy. And they just wreck it all. And that might happen to you in this meditation. You might get really deep one day sitting here and you can't go any further. And that is your obstacle. It's guilt. Something or some reason you think, I don't deserve it. I give you permission on behalf of the Buddha to become totally enlightened, to bliss out, to have more happiness than you've ever had before. So if you have that doubt, say, I've got permission. If you don't believe it, I'll write it on a piece of paper and sign it. I give you permission to be happy. Now you give yourself permission to be happy. Give yourself permission to be free. Give yourself permission to enjoy. If you do that, a huge obstacle has been taken away from your life, from your meditation, from your spiritual goal of enlightenment. If you think you deserve it, then you're free to experience it. But the fear, I don't deserve it, will stop you. So please notice that and let it go. Come on, have a nice time. That's one of the other reasons why there's not so many enlightened beings these days. Because so many guilt trips, anxiety disorders, depressions. So modern life, when we don't value ourselves, we don't give loving kindness to ourselves, and we just too much criticism, not enough praise. So, thank you so much for listening today. You're such wonderful people. You made so much merit. Oh, I think every one of you should bliss out this evening. If you can't bliss out this evening, well, tomorrow morning. So have a nice rest. Be kind to yourself. And see you tomorrow. Good night. Sleep well. Sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. So get out of here. Radish.